Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 12th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, self-medicating animals, a new result in the hunt for dark matter, and a new kind of bipedalism.
Skeletons are overwhelming because you've got all the different parts of the body, and they have to be working in concert with one another.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
In 2009, Science published the first of a series of articles on Australopithecus sediba, a nearly 2-million-year-old hominin that lived 100,000 years after Australopithecus afarensis, commonly known as Lucy. Since the 2008 discovery in a cave in South Africa, researchers have worked their way through the major components of the two individual skeletons. In this week's issue, you can find reports and research articles on sediba dentition, jaws, upper limbs, spine, thorax, and lower limbs. I spoke with Jeremy De Silva about his team's efforts to use the morphology of the lower body to learn more about the locomotion of these ancient hominins.
The paper that we published in Science this week reconstructs the locomotion, precisely how Australopithecus sediba walked around its world. These skeletons give us remarkable insight into locomotion in this particular species because of how well they're preserved. They give us a heel, an ankle, a knee, a hip, and a lower back, and we've never had that before in a single individual. And it allows us to reconstruct how this species moved, and it moved in a really peculiar way.
Let's start off with the basics of Australopithecus sediba.
Sure.
Where and when did these guys live?
So they lived in South Africa. As far as we know, that's where we found them so far, is in a cave known as Malapa Cave in South Africa. The dating of the site is remarkably precise, and we know that these particular individuals lived 1.977 million years ago.
So are they related to modern humans?
Yes.
Really?
There's no question that these things are more closely related to humans than to any other living animal. There are certainly some very interesting anatomies in the teeth and the skull and the hand and the pelvis that suggest that these are a good candidate ancestor for the genus Homo, of which we're the last remaining members. And then there are other anatomies, like the foot, that are even more primitive than what we see in Lucy's species, which would suggest that these things may not be. So it's a very peculiar mixture of anatomies that makes sort of family tree drawing difficult.
What other species fall under Australopithecus?
So there are many. The oldest is called Anamensis, and that goes back over 4 million years. And then there's Lucy's species, Afarensis, which is one of the best known. In South Africa, there's Africanus, and it appears as though Africanus and sediba share a close relationship, that they appear to be close cousins of one another, or maybe even ancestor descendant of one another. There's a species in East Africa known as Garhi, and the last three I named, Garhi, Africanus, and sediba, have all been sort of put forth as possible ancestors of genus Homo. And in some ways, all of them make a case, and in some ways, all of them are problematic, which, again, is part of the fun. And then there's a whole other group of Australopithecus known as the robust Australopithecines, which evolved these wonderful adaptations for digesting a very difficult-to-process diet. And they quite clearly are a side branch. They are a cousin group.
Great. As you mentioned at the beginning, you focus specifically on the lower limbs.
Yep.
And how sediba might have walked.
Right.
What are some of the notable features of these species' feet?
So it all starts with the heel. It has a chimpanzee-like heel. If we had found that calcaneus, that heel bone, just lying on the surface somewhere, this would be an ape.
What does a chimpanzee heel actually look like?
Chimpanzee heels are small. The part that touches the ground tapers to a point. And there's not a lot of surface area, and that's okay for them because they don't walk on two legs. They don't put a lot of force on their heel. But anything that walks on two legs has this problem of having to dissipate force, the kind of force of heel impact through this bone. And so humans and all of the human ancestors we had known about prior to this one Lucy and her kind have a very large heel with a big base to it that's going to help dissipate these forces that occur during heel strike. So something that lived a million years after Lucy certainly should have a big heel, and it doesn't. And whenever we see a weird anatomy like that, sometimes in our field we have a tendency to point towards a pathology and say, ah, it's just a diseased individual. We've got a second individual, and both of them look this way. So this weird chimpanzee-like heel is our starting point, and it means that this creature, in my opinion, was not adapted for heel striking bipedalism. And yet the rest of its skeleton tells us it was bipedal.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about the rest of the skeleton related to walking. What mm-hmm. What do the features tell you about how Sidiba
sure.
walked?
So as I mentioned at the beginning, the remarkable nature of the skeleton, in my opinion, is its completeness. We've got a heel, an ankle, a knee, a hip, and a lower back. All of these anatomies, which are critical for reconstructing upright walking, are odd. We find anatomies that are outside the range of variation that we see in Australopithecus, and in many ways outside the range of variation that we see in modern humans, but in different ways, in different combinations. Sometimes they're more primitive, and sometimes they're even more derived, and yet they all exist in a single individual. Although these anatomies are odd in isolation, we have to think of them working in concert with each other, because they did. This is one individual, one creature that moved around her landscape almost 2 million years ago. And so I started working with a physical therapist named Kenneth Holt. He was able to predict anatomies of this skeleton that he hadn't even seen yet based on the shapes of the bones of the foot, because he saw in the foot something that would have landed, sort of a twisted-in foot, would have landed on the outside of its foot in a flat-footed manner. It wouldn't have hit the ground with a heel strike like we do. And when you land in this manner, and there's some humans today that do this, the ground pushes back on your foot, and it rolls it inward in a motion known as pronation. And if you do this all excessively, or if you do this with high magnitude, we call it hyperpronation. And if you roll your foot inwards, your knee rolls inwards, your hip rolls inwards, and your torso pitches forward over your hip. So people who walk this way have problems. They have foot pain, they have knee problems, they have an increased risk of dislocation of their kneecap. And what we see in these skeletons, it's really quite amazing, are anatomical solutions to the very problems that humans face today if they walk this way.
Huh.
And that suggested to me that then they were adapted for walking in this particular way.
So how does it compare to other bipeds of that era? As you're saying, Lucy, I guess she's not exactly the same era, but...
Sure. We certainly have skeletons that are... We have isolated bones that are more or less the same age. You know, skeletons are rare. But we have many isolated bones, and they don't look like this. Bone for bone, this thing is different than anything else I've ever seen. And to me, that leads to this recognition that this creature is moving on its landscape quite differently than the other species of Australopithecus, which is really cool. I had been a skeptic of the idea that there were multiple ways of being an upright walker. I sort of thought the variation we were seeing in the fossils just mirrored the kind of variation you'd see in humans today. You know, not everyone walks the same way. Not everyone has the same shape to their bones. And when I saw this thing, it exceeded the range of variation that I would expect as normal variation in a population. The differences in these bones are not, you know, idiosyncratic little variations here and there. They're differences that matter functionally, and it means this thing moved differently.
So is there any relationship between this hyperpronation style of locomotion and whether or not Sidiba spent more or less time in the trees?
I think that's exactly what's going on. I certainly would like to see more fossils before I say that with certainty. We need a big toe. I want to know if it's somewhat grasping or not. I've actually been a critic of the argument that Australopithecus spent a lot of time in the trees. And I've made the case in the past that these things, Australopithecus in general, is not very well adapted for life in the trees. And maybe they built night nests and they climbed once a day, but they weren't climbing like chimpanzees do. And I base that on anatomies of the foot and ankle that none of the Australopithecines I'd looked at have these anatomies until now. Sidiba has these anatomies. So if these anatomies matter, which I think they do, then it means Sidiba was a tree climber and a pretty good one.
This is actually part of a package of papers about Sidiba that we're publishing in the issue. And we've published several other articles on this topic. How does this latest bunch of articles relate to what we've seen in the past?
Well, it fleshes out the rest of the anatomy. The papers that have published in the past focused on specific regions of the body, like the pelvis, the hand, the foot and ankle. And these papers now complete the anatomy. We're now getting a look at what the back, the rib cage, the shoulder and the arm, the lower leg, the mandible and the teeth are like in this creature. And it's such a remarkable mosaic of anatomies.
It seems to me that it'd be really hard to study something that's so old and there's so little material out there. Can you talk about some of the challenges?
It's overwhelming. I, for the most part, have been trained to work on isolated fossils because that's what we find. We find an isolated ankle here and there. We find an isolated heel or an isolated metatarsal, and I work on those and try to reconstruct, in general, what the animal was doing based on this isolated fossil because that's usually what we find. Mm-hmm. Skeletons are overwhelming because you've got all the different parts of the body and they have to be working in concert with one another, which is why working with a physical therapist has been so critical, I think, for us to formulate the hypothesis that's out there now of how this thing walked.
Jeremy De Silva, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Jeremy De Silva and colleagues write about the lower limb mechanics of Australopithecus sediba as part of a special package this week. You can also read more reports from the latest issue, see a new story by Ann Gibbons, and catch up on earlier results at www.sciencemag.org/extra/sediba. That's S-E-D-I-B-A. Hey, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible, and there's a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And as usual, we're offering some recommendations of our own. I went with Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's really incredible how important this one woman has been for modern medicine, especially given the social and ethical implications surrounding her involvement in it. And so what about you, Sarah?
Okay, Carrie. Well, this week I picked a book by another Science News contributing correspondent, Virginia Morell's Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures.
Okay. Well, I hope you get a chance to check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. The terms medicine and medication carry very specific human and technological connotations for most of us. You can't have pills, prescriptions, and doctors without people. But we're not the only species that tries to treat and prevent our own diseases. According to Jaap de Rode, scientists are beginning to appreciate that medication doesn't require high cognitive abilities, and subsequently, that it's much more common in animals than was previously thought. He walked me through what medication means in the natural world and how we can spot it.
Medicine in animals is actually very similar to how we think of it in humans. And in this particular perspective, he really focused on medication as used against parasitic disease. So not in case of other ailments, which of course could also be used by animals. Hmm. And really we can think of it very similar to what humans do. It's really the use of chemical compounds or other species, including plants, that they find in their environment and that they use in response either to infection with a parasitic disease or in terms of the risk or a perceived risk of infection. Or we could use medication as a precaution, and that we often call prophylaxis. And animals can do that too.
So when we talk about animals medicating, is this a conscious decision, do you think, that they know that, well, when I'm feeling this, I should go and eat this plant? Or is it more of an innate, instinctive behavior?
I think that these behaviors can be either learned and conscious, or they can be based on instincts and therefore be more like innate behaviors. What used to be the idea is that it has to be a very conscious behavior, that animals have to have big brains and have high cognitive skills to learn and to make associations. And I think what we're seeing now is that there is a lot of examples of animals medicating themselves that don't have those very highly evolved cognitive skills. A lot of insects turn out to be very good medicators themselves. And we think that in those cases, they are more innate behaviors that get passed on from generation to generation.
Okay, well, let's talk about some specific examples then. So you mentioned that there's medication in response to a parasite. There's also prophylaxis to prevent against a parasite. Tell me a little bit more about how those two kinds of medication work.
Yes, so if we think about therapeutic medication, that is really medication in response to disease. The best examples that we have known for a long time come from primates, for example, chimpanzees that have some ailment. Often they may have gut parasites, worms living in their gut. They don't feel good, and then they eat particular plants. And these plants, they don't eat for food. And we know that because these primates then eat particular leaves. They swallow them whole instead of chewing them, and this may expel parasites from their gut. There is an example from woolly bear caterpillars that when they're infected with parasitoid flies, they actually increase the intake of particular alkaloids from their diet that are actually bad for the parasitoid flies, and they can actually kill the parasitoid flies. So these are examples of therapeutic medication, but then there are examples of prophylaxis where animals use a form of medication to prevent infection, and that can be either for themselves or it can be preventing infection of their offspring or other relatives. There is baboons that eat particular berries that have antiparasitic chemicals in the season where parasitism rates could really increase. And the idea here is that the risk of parasitism goes up and these animals start eating berries that will prevent the infection of these parasites. Mm. The fruit flies are really interesting because when the mothers perceive that there are parasitoid wasps in the environment, they prefer to lay their eggs in food that is high in ethanol that will then reduce infection in their offspring.
So how can we tell which of these behaviors are actually evolved forms of medication itself? I mean, for instance, these berries that some primates may ingest, you know, how do we know that those berries just don't taste really good?
That's a very good question, and it's a really difficult question. It's really difficult in general to demonstrate that any phenotype that we see or any behavior that we see is really an evolved behavior for the reason that we ascribe to it. And this is especially difficult with big animals that have really long generation times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one reason why we're seeing a lot of studies now appearing on insects, because insects we can rear in the lab, and then you have a proper control, because you can say, well, now we have the animals that are infected. If they do something different, now they start eating a medicinal food that will then reduce parasite infection and will increase their fitness. But the animals that don't have the parasite or don't have the risk of the parasite don't display that behavior. You have a much stronger indication that that behavior is indeed an adaptation to the infection with the parasites. One thing I always like to tell people is that there is a lot of similarities between animal medication and medication that humans use. And when we look at human drugs that we use against our parasites and our diseases, they often have side effects. And in other words, we don't want to use these drugs all the time. They're very good for us when we are infected because the negative effects of the drug on the parasite are often worse than they are on us.
Hmm.
But when we are not infected, we don't want to take these drugs because they have side effects and they make us sick.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this plays a role in the animal world as well. A lot of the cases, we see that animals only use the medicines or only increase the intake of particular chemicals when they are infected with parasites, so really only when they need them. And when they don't need them, they don't use them. And if they did, they would really suffer these costs and actually decrease their fitness.
So why is it that you think that we've generally underestimated the amount that animals medicate? I mean, you mentioned that we often thought that this was the result of a high cognitive ability. You know, what is causing sort of this reexamination of medication in animals?
Well, I think that is part of it. The idea previously that the animals really have to be very clever, you know, and be able to make associations and have really high-level learning processes, that is the only way in which animals could do this. I think that has maybe stood in the way of progress in the field. I think the other thing is that people have very much focused on medication of the individual itself.
Hmm.
What we are seeing in a lot of these examples is that individuals don't treat themselves, but they treat their offspring or they treat other relatives. And I think once you look at it from that level, and then you look at it at the level from the gene instead of the individual, then you can actually see that there may be a lot more examples of medication in nature.
So as you said, scientists are having to move beyond the notion that medication is the result of higher cognitive abilities. So what then is the reason for why some animals have evolved the ability to medicate and others haven't?
I think that animals in general have solved the problems of life in different ways. One of the questions we are interested in, and that is one of the things we point out, is that there are alternative ways in which animals may deal with their diseases. So say an animal is really good at medication, maybe it doesn't need a very good immune system that deals with parasites once the parasite gets into the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question I think that will be addressed in the years to come when people start thinking about this more. So my view would be that animals have solved the problems of disease in different ways, and some have gone down using very highly evolved specific cells that tackle parasites when they get into the body, and other animals may have solved the problem using behaviors.
So the subjects of medication, immune systems, host-parasite interactions are, you know, clearly very highly relevant to humans as well.
Yes.
So what are the lessons that we can draw from the subject of medication in animals?
Yeah, I think there are two that are directly relevant to humans, I think. And the first is that when we look at nature and we look at all these animals that have evolved for millions of years with their parasites and their diseases in the wild, and they have found ways to tackle them, we could actually learn a lot from them. For example, if we look at animals and they see that they use particular chemicals, maybe we can try to use those chemicals against our own parasites. So in a way, it could be a form of drug discovery. There's one example that comes to mind, the potential avenue for future drugs, and that is the use of resin by honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
So resin is a product from plants, and bees, as well as ants actually, they collect this and put it in their nest. And these resins have antimicrobial properties. And when you do some isolation of the chemicals from these, other researchers have shown that you can isolate chemicals that work against viruses in vitro. So that is a really interesting topic that may warrant further research. The other thing that I think we should realize is that when we use agriculture, we often put animals in completely different environments than they have evolved in.
Mm.
And what we take away from them is the possibility to use medicine to deal with their own parasites. For example, it's really difficult for beekeepers to deal with that sticky resin in their hives,
mm.
and they have really selected for bees that don't use it anymore. If we can learn from animals and see what do they actually do themselves to get rid of their diseases, maybe we should keep it so we're actually benefiting from it in our agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, Jaap de Rode, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Jaap de Rode and colleagues write about medication in animals in our perspective this week.
Hypothetically, most of the mass in our universe is dark matter. It's hypothetical in the sense that adding dark matter's mass into equations balances things out, and we can calculate the gravitational effects of dark matter on astronomical objects. But researchers have been unable to detect it in any direct way, either by taking measurements in space or by using atom smashers here on Earth. We know very few of its characteristics beyond its massive size, and only that in aggregate. I spoke with Adrian Cho about the state of dark matter research, starting with recent measurements from a space-based detector.
This story is important for a couple of reasons. Scientifically, physicists think that they're closing in on an explanation of what dark matter may be, and the hope is that within, 10 years, they may make a breakthrough there and finally be able to answer this question that's been lingering for decades. At the same time, this particular experiment, which is known as the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, is the only big experiment on the space station. And it's been in the works for nearly two decades. It's been quite controversial. It's very expensive. And it's essentially the product of one person's will, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Samuel Ting from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, came up with this idea of putting a world-class particle detector up on the space station to take an unprecedented look at cosmic rays. And that was back in the mid-90s, and it was supposed to be a relatively cheap thing to do. And in the end, it's turned out to be very expensive. And it's not quite clear how AMS will pay off scientifically. So obviously there's just a lot of interest in this experiment, and this is the first big result from it. So obviously the whole world, at least physics fans, were watching.
Cool. So what does the AMS do?
So the AMS is basically a particle detector like you might see at an atom smasher, like the Large Hadron Collider in Europe. So it's able to track charged particles very, very accurately. to identify what they are. So, you know, whether a particle is a proton or a lighter electron, an antiproton or antielectron or electron, all that can be determined by this very complex particle detector that has many different systems for measuring the energy and momentum of the particle. It's very sophisticated, weighs about 7 tons. And basically, the advantage of AMS is that it's way up above the atmosphere and it's going to be there for years. So if everything goes well, it will be able to take really unprecedented data of cosmic rays.
You mentioned that it's targeting cosmic rays. Is it measuring anything else, or is that the only thing it's looking at?
Pretty much that's what it's looking at. Of course, cosmic rays come in all kinds of different flavors, if you will, right? Most cosmic rays in our neighborhood are protons pumped out by the sun, but they're also electrons. There are anti-electrons, which are called positrons. There are antiprotons. There are nuclei stripped of their electrons coming from different places. And so AMS aims to measure all of these. But the really big result that they were aiming for right away was a measurement of anti-electrons or positrons from space. And the reason for that is that there had been previous reports that if you look at the ratio of positrons to the sum total of positrons and electrons, that at high energies, that ratio is curiously high. It ought to be quite low, as most of the run-of-the-mill astrophysical sources of particles should pump out a lot more electrons and positrons. But a couple of groups had seen that the so-called positron fraction actually goes up at higher energies, and that could be a sign that what's happening is that out there in our corner of the galaxy, there are particles of dark matter floating around, and every once in a while, two of them will crash into each other and they'll annihilate each other and eventually produce an electron-positron pair. So if you've got a lot of that going on, the ratio of electrons to positrons comes up closer to 50-50, and it seems to have bumped up, you know, by sort of 5% to 10, 15% in the energy range that we're looking at. And so that was the big thing that AMS was hoping to find.
Is that what they found? Is that what this first measurement is?
Absolutely. Their measurement is far better than any previous measurement of this. It's got far smaller errors. And indeed, they see this excess of positrons. So it's consistent with the dark matter interpretation.
But the existence of dark matter isn't the only explanation for this imbalance. What are some of the alternative explanations, and how can we distinguish between them?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. So it's possible that this excess of positrons comes about from these dark matter particles smashing into each other and annihilating and creating electrons and positrons. It's also possible, however, that these positrons could come out of a sort of more conventional astrophysical source, such as a spinning neutron star called a pulsar. If a pulsar is somewhere out there, not too far away, but not too close at the same time, it's possible that it would crank out enough positrons to produce a similar type of signal. So most researchers agree that this kind of excess is not a smoking gun for dark matter, certainly not just yet.
And you also mentioned that the observations here may paint dark matter into a corner. What do you mean by that?
So it turns out that details of the AMS measurement itself may be a little bit tricky to explain with a dark matter scenario. The AMS result shows that the spectrum for this excess of positrons extends to a higher energy than had been seen before, and that means that these putative dark matter particles that are annihilating each other would have to be even heavier than previously thought. In the units that physicists use, they'd have to weigh, you know, at least 300 or 400 gigaelectron volts. And it turns out that that actually kind of strains the theory. If the dark matter particles get too heavy, then there's a kind of chain of reasoning that gets a little bit tenuous. There have to be fewer of them in numbers because you don't want too much dark matter, but then if there are fewer of them to produce the signal at all, they would have to interact really, really strongly, and if they interact too strongly, then this whole notion that they're somehow dark and hard to see becomes a little untenable.
So going back a little bit, we talked about how this might actually be a pulsar spewing out these high-speed particles. Is there a way of telling that it's not a pulsar? Is the AMS going to be able to do that?
Yeah, that is also the sort of $64,000 question. Can AMS by itself figure out what's going on here? And I talked to Sam Ting, and he says yes. He's quite optimistic about this. It turns out that if these positrons were coming from dark matter annihilations, then their energy should be limited because the most energy they can get is determined by the mass of the dark matter particles that are colliding, right? So there should be some sudden cutoff at some high energy above which you shouldn't see this excess anymore because the particles are just not heavy enough to give birth to positrons with any more energy. Mm-hmm. So he says that with more data, which may come in, you know, a couple of years, they'll be able to see up to higher energies and see if this excess just suddenly falls off a cliff. And if that happens, he argues that's very strong evidence for a dark matter interpretation. And then this is where it gets complicated, because if you talk to astrophysicists, they argue that this sharp cutoff would not be an unambiguous sign for dark matter, because they argue that even with a pulsar or, say, a supernova remnant, which is sort of the leftovers from a stellar explosion, you can get these cutoffs in various ways, and that it's not impossible to think of an astrophysical explanation that would give you a cutoff. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a lot of debate over this, and it's going to come down to, you know, who comes up with an explanation that's simpler and less contrived. But if you talk to the astrophysicists, they're not actually very optimistic that AMS alone is going to be able to decide this issue.
So, yeah, what about down here on the ground? Is there something we can do with a collider that would maybe answer some of these questions?
Yeah, so it's kind of ironic. The astrophysicists that I talked to pointed to experiments with an atom smasher as a way to get a better handle on this. So it turns out that these dark matter particles, which have this cute name WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. So it turns out that according to most theories of WIMPs, or at least some theories of WIMPs, if these things exist at all, then you ought to be able to make them in particle collisions at an atom smasher like the Large Hadron Collider. So there's this hope, right, that if they actually exist, that you would be able to spot them being produced at the LHC, which itself is a kind of tricky measurement because you're producing a particle that doesn't actually leave any visible track, but they think they know how to handle that. So the astrophysicists that I talked to were quite adamant that to really clinch a dark matter explanation for the AMS results, you're going to need some sort of proof that you're producing these WIMPs at the LHC. It's not going to happen right away because the LHC is shut down for a couple of years for repairs and won't come back on until 2015.
Okay. Well, so are there any other efforts out there to pin down dark matter's existence?
Actually, there are a lot of them. There are other astrophysical cosmic ray experiments that could probe what's going on, you know, even to higher energies that go up on balloons. There's no arguing that AMS is the best cosmic ray detector that's ever spent this much time up in space, right? I mean, it's unprecedented in that regard. But it's not the only cosmic ray experiment out there. And there are other ideas, you know, that if there are these dark matter annihilations, they should also produce particles of light called gamma rays. And so there are gamma ray telescopes on Earth that are trying to look for gamma rays, you know, say from the heart of the galaxy where you would expect there to be more dark matter. There are also a whole number of experiments that are actually trying to do what's called direct detection, where you have a very, very sensitive particle detector and you put it way deep down underground where it's shielded from the cosmic rays, and you essentially wait and hope that you see a dark matter particle, a WIMP, come in and bump into an atom and produce a very faint signal. So there's really kind of these three different approaches to dark matter, and the real hope is they all start to see something that's consistent. Mm-hmm. And if that happens in the next decade, then, you know, it could be there'll be a real breakthrough and dark matter will be discovered. So I guess the real question is, where does AMS sit in all of this? And it's really kind of a particular position, because they didn't discover this positron excess, but I think it's fair to say they really proved to most people's satisfaction that it's real and not just some sort of artifact of not quite so good particle detector. So that's a contribution. So it's possible that if this all pans out and 10 years from now we're all very excited because physicists have discovered particles of dark matter, it's possible that people will look back and say, yeah, this really started to get interesting with the AMS results. But, you know, even then, to be fair, AMS is not the first experiment to see this positron excess. So it's a very delicate situation, I think.
Great. All right. Well, Adrian Cho, thanks so much for talking with me.
Sure. My pleasure, Sarah.
Adrian Cho is a staff writer for Science. He writes about the state of dark matter research in this week's issue.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who is going to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, we're looking at quantifying pain.
Right. Well, Carrie, if you've ever gone to the doctor's office in pain, sometimes they make you fill out that chart, that 1 to 10 of sort of frowny faces to smiley faces. How much pain are you in? Well, the problem with that is that's all really subjective, and doctors would love a way to sort of, like, they take your temperature and they get a number, look at something in your brain, maybe a scan of your brain, and be able to tell actually quantitatively how much pain you're in. Nothing's really come close to that. Some fMRI studies, looks at activity in the brain, have shown that certain regions of the brain light up when people think about painful thoughts or social rejection. But that's not really the same as physical pain. And that's really what the researchers were trying to get at in this study.
Right. And so that could also determine, you know, kind of a yes or no about thinking or experiencing pain. But how do we actually quantify it?
Well, what the researchers did was they took about 100 or so healthy participants, and they induced some pain. They had what was basically a hot plate connected to the volunteers' arms, and they were cranking up the temperature. At first, they started with about 44 degrees Celsius, which is not too bad, and that went up to 49 degrees Celsius, which is kind of like a hot cup of coffee. So it started to get painful. And what the researchers noticed is they increased the temperature and therefore increased the pain. They were seeing various regions of the brain light up. And what was really important was these regions didn't really light up when people thought about social rejection, when they thought about maybe their ex-girlfriends or boyfriends. So this wasn't emotional pain. This was physical pain that the brain was responding to.
So were the researchers actually able to correlate the amount of pain to the parts of the brain that were lighting up?
Yeah, they found that the pain signature, as they call it, scaled with the increase in temperature. So the more pain the subjects were feeling, the stronger the pain signature. What they also found was that when they gave subjects a pain-relieving chemical, this pain signature went away. So again, it really suggested this was really tied to physical pain as opposed to other types of pain.
So what's a situation in which we might actually take advantage of this kind of technology?
Well, you know, for one thing, again, you know, doctors really wanted this non-subjective measurement of pain. Also could help them determine how much drugs to administer. And also for people that aren't verbal, doctors could still be able to determine how much pain they're in without actually having to talk to them. So there's really a lot of uses here. This is still kind of a small study, so the researchers clearly want to do some more work, but a really promising result for researchers that want to objectively quantify how much pain we're in.
And our next story is all about the relationship between sight and communication.
Well, Carrie, this story has to do with how much eye contact influences our development early in life. There's been some anecdotal evidence that if we don't have eye contact with our parents, especially our mothers, very early in life when we're babies, that we can develop a lot of social disorders. For example, children that are severely neglected in orphanages or children that are born blind are more likely to have traits of autism. They have a hard time forming social attachments. They tend to be more hyperactive. They even have cognitive impairment. And that's not a surprise because researchers have long thought that this loving gaze between mother and child helps build social skills that can last a lifetime. But these are pretty extreme examples. And for the new study, the researchers wanted to see, can we get a better sense of how much eye contact really matters in these early stages of life?
So how did they tackle that question?
Well, instead of looking at blind babies, they looked at blind mothers. They actually studied five babies that were born to mothers that couldn't see. They studied various aspects of the children's visual, motor, and language skills at various stages of development from 6 to 10 months, 12 to 15 months, and 24 to 47 months. And what they found, which was really surprising, was that the children of blind mothers did just as well on all of these tests that the researchers gave them as the children that were born to mothers with normal vision.
Wow. So what does that say about the way in which we learn and develop eye contact and eyesight?
Well, it suggests that this eye contact itself is not the ultimate determiner of our development of these social skills. Again, it's only five children. It's a small study, but it suggests that other things can be equally as important. A loving touch, caressing, talking to, things like that. Another really interesting thing about the study was not only did these children seem to do just as well as children born to sighted mothers, but in some cases they actually did better. A lot of them did better on verbal tests. They outscored their peers in visual tasks, such as remembering the location of a hidden toy or switching their attention from one toy to another. So that was really interesting. And the researchers think it could be analogous to children that are born to parents that speak two different languages. Mm-hmm. Studies have shown that children that grow up bilingual also have some advantages. And this is sort of bilingual, you know, learning how to deal with an adult that has sight and an adult that doesn't have sight causes these children to switch between various modes of communication early in development, and that could actually give them some advantages.
Well, very cool. And finally, our third story here presents some really interesting findings from dinosaur eggs.
Carrie, this story also has to do with early development, but this is even earlier in development than the example we were talking about in the previous story. This is embryonic development, and it's not humans, it's dinosaurs. This story has to do with a dinosaur called Lophangosaurus, which lived about 200 million years ago in the Yunnan province in southern China. What was really cool about these dinosaurs is they were the biggest creatures around at the time. This was during the Jurassic period. They were 9 meters long. And what researchers have long wondered is, how do these animals get so big?
Not having been present in the Jurassic period, how can we begin to answer that?
Well, thankfully, we have fossils. And actually, in this study, they had some really interesting fossils. They had what was essentially a bone bed of fossils from dinosaur embryos that had been scattered by various floods. Now, usually that's a bad thing. When you have scattering of all these bones, it's difficult to match up, you know, what bones belong to which individual. But here, actually, that turned out to be an advantage because researchers knew that they were dealing with a lot of different embryos of the same species of dinosaur. And what was cool is because these floods kept on rushing into these nest beds, they were really killing these dinosaurs and these embryos at various stages of development. So the researchers were really able to see how fast these dinosaurs grew in their eggs. And what they noticed...
Bad for the dinosaurs, good for us.
Bad for the dinosaurs, good for us. And what they noticed was that looking at the sizes of the femur bones of the dinosaurs, also looking at what's called the vascular spaces, these are spaces where blood vessels and other tissues can grow into, what they were noticing was that these dinosaurs were growing incredibly fast, faster than any other known dinosaur on record, and faster actually than any other bird species or any other animal that scientists have studied.
So this is really making a link between embryo development and the final size of the organism.
Exactly. And what's really cool about this study is that the interesting results don't end there. The researchers, when they bombarded these bones with powerful X-rays, they actually found traces of what they suspect is organic matter inside the bones, which is really rare to find, especially in fossils this old. Now, there's been organic matter found in dinosaur fossils before. It's always been controversial. There's never been conclusive proof that these organic remains, sometimes which seem to be the remains of proteins, which may be the case here too, are not just contamination. But if it actually is true organic matter belonging to these dinosaurs, it would be the oldest organic matter on record and would really potentially shed some more light on what these dinosaurs were really made of.
Oh, well, how interesting. I can't wait to hear more about this.
Stay tuned.
So what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story on how new music rewards the brain, and also a very cool photograph of a ghostly green bubble in space. For Science Insider, our policy blog, the big story this week is President Obama's 2014 science budget, just which agencies are going to be the winners and losers of that, some of the big programs that are going to be cut, which programs are going to stay. We'll have continuing breaking news and analysis of that on the site. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about Jurassic Park. Speaking of dinosaurs, Jurassic Park, 20 years later. I know I told you guys last week that we were having that chat. We had some technical difficulties. We are rerunning it again this week, and we're hoping that it will be a video chat. We've got one of the world's most famous dinosaur experts, Jack Horner, on, who's been a consultant for all of the Jurassic Park movies, so be sure to check that out. Also, next week's Science Live will be on genetic privacy, just how much control should we have over our own genetic information. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And And that concludes the April 12, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.